a fool.
He looked at me and nodded.
You were wise to tell me of his plans. It is good we shall be leaving him behind.
There seemed nothing to say to that. I left the Sea Watch Tower, going, as I had come, through the dark maze hidden within the walls of Buckkeep. I had seen both my friend and my mentor more clearly today than I liked. I wondered if the fool's touch on my wrist had been a demonstration for both Chade and me of the influence he had over me. And yet, it had not felt that way. Had he not asked me first if I wished for it? Still, it had felt as if it were a thing he wished to display to me. Yet had it been only circumstances that had made him reveal it to Chade as well? Or had his intent been that I see clearly how Chade regarded me, how he assumed he could always depend on me to do his will? I shook my head. Could the fool imagine I did not already know that? I clenched my teeth. There would come a moment when the fool realized Chade and I had conspired against him, a moment when he knew how I had held my tongue today. I went back to my workroom, and I did not like any of the thoughts I took there with me. As I pushed open the door, I instantly knew that the fool had been there before me. He left his gift on the table beside my chair. I walked over to it and ran a finger down Night Eye's spine. My wolf was in his prime in the carving. A dead rabbit sprawled between his forepaws. His head was lifted, his dark eyes regarding me intelligently. Patiently. I picked it up. I had seen the fool begin the carving when he sat at the table in my cabin. I had never guessed what it might be, had almost forgotten that he had promised to show it to me when it was finished. I touched the points of Night Eye's pricked ears. Then I sat down in the chair and stared into the fire, my wolf cradled in my hands.
Chapter 4. An Exchange of Weapons. Weapons Master Hod ascended to that title after long service as journeyman to Weapons Master Krend. Her years in that position were well spent, for she became familiar not only with the use of each weapon, but the manufacture of good blades. Indeed, there are still some who say that her primary talent was in the creation of fine weapons, and that Buckkeep would have been better served to give another the title of Weapons Master and keep her at the forge. King Shrewd, however, did not see it that way. Upon Kren's death, she was immediately moved into his position, and oversaw the training of all Buckkeep's men-at-arms. She served the Farseer Rain well, ultimately giving her life in battle for then-king-in-waiting Verity. Fedren's Chronicles. The fool's carefully planned disposal of his possessions sparked in me a sudden desire to sort out my own belongings. That night, instead of packing, I sat on the corner of Chade's old bed, surrounded by all I owned. If I had been inclined to the fool's fatalistic melancholy, perhaps it would have saddened me. Instead, I found myself grinning at the paucity of it. Even Gilly the ferret, nosing through my trove, seemed unimpressed. The stack of clothing from the fool's chamber and the marvellous sword with the over-decorated hilt comprised most of it. My clothing from my days in the cottage had largely been consigned to the rag heap near the work table. I possessed two new uniforms as a prince's guard. One was already carefully packed in a sea chest at the foot of my bed with my other changes of clothing. Concealed beneath them were a number of small packages of poisons, sedatives, and restoratives which Chade and I had prepared. On the bed beside me, various small tools, lockpicks, and other handy oddments were in a small roll that could be concealed inside my shirt. I added it to the sea chest. I sorted through the rest of my strange collection as I waited for Dutiful. The carving of Night Eyes was on the mantel over the hearth. I would not risk it on the journey with me. There was a charm necklace that Jinna the Hedge Witch had made for me when we were on friendlier terms. I'd never wear it again, and yet I was oddly reluctant to dispose of it. I set it with the clothing Lord Golden had inflicted on me. The little fox pin that Catrican had given me rode where it always did, inside my shirt, above my heart. I had no intention of parting from that. To one side, I had placed a few items for Hap,
Most were small things I'd made or acquired when he was a child, a spinning top, a jumping jack and the like. I packed them carefully into a box with an acorn carved on the lid. I'd give them to him when I bid him farewell. In the centre of my bed was the bundle of carved feathers I'd taken from the other's beach. Once, I had tried to give them to the fool, to try in his carved wooden crown. I was certain they would fit, but he had given them a single glance and then rejected them. I unrolled the soft leather I'd wrapped them in, considered each of them briefly, and then wrapped them again. For a time I debated what to do with them. Then I tucked them into a corner of the sea chest. Into it also went my needles and various weights of thread for them, extra shoes and small clothes, a razor, mug, bowl, and spoon for the ship. And that was it. There was nothing else to pack, and precious little else in the world that belonged to me. There was my horse, my black, but she had little interest in me beyond doing what she must. She preferred her own kind, and would not miss me at all. A stable boy would exercise her regularly, and as long as Hans was in charge of Buckkeep stables, I had no fear that she would be neglected or ill-used. Gilly emerged from the heap of clothing and came romping across the bed to challenge me. "Small chance you'll miss me either," I told him, as he menaced my hand playfully. There were plenty of mice and rats in the walls of Buckkeep to keep him well fed. He'd probably enjoy having the whole bed to himself. He already believed that the pillow belonged to him. My gaze wandered over the room. Chade had taken possession of all the scrolls I'd brought back from my cabin. He'd sorted them, adding the harmless ones to the Buckkeep library and securing in his cabinets any that told too many truths too plainly. I felt no sense of loss. I carried the armload of clothing over to one of Chade's old wardrobes, intending to stuff it all inside. Then my conscience smote me, and I carefully shook out and folded each garment before putting it away. In the process, I realized that, taken individually, many of the garments were not as ostentatious as I had imagined them. I added the warmly lined cloak to my sea chest. When all of the clothing was stored or packed, I set the jeweled sword on top of the chest. It would go with me. Despite its showy hilt, it was well made and finely balanced. Like the man who had given it to me, its glittering appearance obscured its true purpose. There was a courteous tap, and the wine rack swung out of the way. As Dutiful stepped wearily into the room, Gilly leapt from the bed and sprang to confront him, menacing him with white teeth as he made abortive springs at his feet. "Yes, I'm glad to see you too," Dutiful greeted him and swept the little animal up in one hand. He scratched the ferret's throat gently and then set him down. Gilly immediately attacked his feet. Being careful not to tread upon him, Dutiful came into the room, saying, "You had something extra for me to pack?" With a heavy sigh, he dropped down onto the bed beside me. "I'm so tired of packing," he confided. "I hope it's something small." "It's on the table," I told him, "and it's not small." As we walked towards the work table, I knew a moment of intense regret, and would have undone the gift if I could. How could it possibly mean to this boy what it had to me? He looked at it, and then looked up at me, shock on his face. "I don't understand. You're giving me a sword?" I stood up. "It's your father's sword. Verity gave it to me when we last parted. It's yours now," I said quietly. The look that overtook Dutiful's face in that moment erased any regret I might have felt. He put out a hand toward it, drew it back, and then looked at me. Incredulous wonder shone in his face. I smiled. "I said it was yours. Pick it up and get the feel of it. I've just cleaned and sharpened it, so be careful." He reached his hand down and set it on the hilt. I waited, watching for him to lift it and discover its exquisite balance. But he drew his hand back. "No." The word shocked me. Then, "Wait here, please, just wait." And then he turned and fled the room. I heard the scuff of his running footsteps fade in the hidden corridor. His reaction puzzled me. He had seemed so delighted at first. I walked over and looked again at the blade. Freshly oiled and wiped, it gleamed. It was both beautiful and elegant, yet there was nothing in its design that would interfere with its intended function. It was a tool for killing other men. It had been made for Verity by Hod, the same weapons master who had taught me to wield both blade and pike. When Verity had gone on in his quest, she had gone with him, and died for him. It was a sword worthy of a king. Why had Dutiful rejected it? I was sitting before the hearth, a hot cup of tea between my two hands, when he returned. He carried a long, wrapped bundle with him. He was talking and untying the leather thongs that bound it as he came through the door.
"I don't know why I didn't think of this a long time ago, when my mother first told me who you were. I guess because it was given to me so long ago, and then my mother put it away for me. Here."
The wrappings fell away from it, and he flourished it aloft. Grinning widely, he suddenly reversed his grip on it and proffered it to me, the hilt resting on his left forearm. He grinned at me, his eyes blazing with delight and anticipation.
"Take it, Fitz Chivalry Farseer. Your father's sword."
A shiver ran over me, standing up every hair on my body. I set the teacup aside and came slowly to my feet.
Chivalry's sword? Yes.
I had not thought his grin could grow wider, but it did. I stared at it. Yes. Even without his words, I would have known it. This blade was the elder brother to the one Verity had carried. It resembled the other sword, but this one was slightly more ornate and longer. Designed for a man taller than Verity, there was a stylized buck on the crossguard. It was, I suddenly knew, a sword made for a prince who would be king. I knew I could never bear it. I longed for it all the same.
"Where did you get it?"
I asked breathlessly.
"Patience had it, of course.
She'd left it at Withywood's when she came to Buckkeep. Then, when she was sorting the clutter, as she put it, after the end of the Redship War, when she was moving her household to Tradeford, she came across it, in a closet. Just as well I never took it to Buckkeep, she told me, when she gave it to me. Regal would have taken it and sold it, or kept it for himself." It was so like Patience that I had to smile. A king's sword amongst her clutter.
"Take it,"
Dutiful commanded me eagerly, and I had to. I had to feel at least once how my hand would fit where my father's had rested. As I took it from him, it felt near weightless. It perched in my hand like a bird. The moment I relieved Dutiful of it, he stepped to the table and took up Verity's sword. I heard his exclamation of satisfaction and grinned as he gripped it in two hands and swept it through the air. These blades were proper swords, as fit to shear through flesh as skewer some vulnerable point. For a time, we were both like boys as we moved the blades in a variety of ways, from the small shifts of the hand and wrist that would block and divert an opponent's thrust to a reckless overhand slash by Dutiful that stopped just short of the scrolls on the tabletop. Chivalry's blade fit me. There was satisfaction in that, even as I realized how woefully unworthy my skills were to a weapon such as this. I was little more than competent with a sword. I wondered how the abdicated king would have felt to know that his only son was defter with an axe than with a sword, and more inclined to use poison than either of those. It was a disheartening line of thought. But before I could give in to that blight, Dutiful was at my side, comparing his blade to mine.
"Chivalry's is longer."
He was taller than Verity. "Yet this blade, I think, is lighter. Verity had the brawn to put behind a heavy stroke, and so I think Hod made his weapon. It will be interesting to see which weapon fits you best when you are grown." He took my meaning instantly.
"Fitz, I gave you that sword to keep. I mean it."
I nodded. "And I thank you for that thought. But I shall have to be satisfied with the intention in place of the reality. This is a king's sword, Dutiful. It is not for a guardsman, let alone an assassin or a bastard. See, look here, on the hilt. The Farseer buck, large and plain. It's on Verity's too, but smaller. Even so, I wrapped the hilt in leather to disguise it in the years after the Redship Wars. Anyone who had seen it would have known it couldn't properly belong to me. This would be even more obvious." Regretfully and respectfully, I set it down on the work table. Dutiful deposited Verity's blade carefully beside it. A stubborn look came over his face.
"How can I take my father's sword from you if you won't take Chivalry's from me? My father gave you that blade. He meant you to have it."
"I'm sure he did at that moment, and for many years it served me well. To see it in your hands will serve me even better." I know that Verity would agree with me. For now, Chivalry's blade we should both set aside. When you are crowned, your nobles will expect to see the king's sword on your hip. Dutiful scowled in thought.
"Didn't King Shrewd have a sword? What became of it?"
"Doubtless he did, As to what became of it, I've no idea. Perhaps Patience had the right of it. Perhaps Regal sold it, or carried it off for other scavengers to steal after he died. In any case, it's gone. When the time comes for you to ascend the throne, I think you should carry the king's sword. And when you sail for Aslevial, I think you should wear your father's sword.
I shall. But won't folk wonder where I got it?
I doubt it. We'll have Chade put out some tale that he has been holding it for you. Folk love stories of that sort. They'll be happy to accept it. He nodded thoughtfully, then said slowly,
It takes some of the pleasure from it, that you cannot carry chivalry's sword as openly as I shall carry this one.
For me also, I replied with painful honesty. Would that I could, Dutiful, but that is simply how it is. I have a sword given to me by Lord Golden, also of a quality that exceeds my skill. I'll carry that. If I ever lift a blade to defend you, it had better be an axe. He looked down, pondering. Then he set his hand to the hilt of chivalry's sword.
Until the day when you give this sword back to me. On the day I am crowned, I wish it to remain here with you. He took a breath. And when I take your father's sword from you, I will return my father's sword to you.
That was a gesture I could not refuse. Soon he left as he had come, taking Verity's sword with him. I made myself a fresh cup of tea, and sat considering my father's blade. I tried to think what it meant to me, but encountered only a curious absence inside myself. Even my recent discovery that he had not ignored me, but had skill-watched me through his brother's eyes, did not make up for his physical absence in my life. Perhaps he had loved me, from afar, but Burrick had been the one to discipline me, and Chade the one to teach me. I looked at the blade and groped for a sense of connection, for any emotion at all, but could not find one. By the time I had finished my tea, I still had no answer, nor was I completely certain what my question was. But I had resolved that I would find time to see Hap again before I departed. I went to bed, successfully claiming the pillow from Gilly. Nonetheless, I slept badly, and even that poor rest was interrupted. Nettle edged into my dreams like a child reluctantly seeking comfort. It was a peculiar contrast. In my dream, I was crossing a steep scree slope from my sojourn into the mountains. I had crossed this avalanche-prone incline, carrying the fool's lax body. I was not so burdened in my dream, but the mountainside seemed steeper, and the fall eternal. Loose pebbles shifted treacherously under my feet. At any moment I might go sliding off the face of the mountain like the small stones rattling past me. My muscles ached with tension, and sweat streamed down my back. Then I caught a flash of motion at the corner of my eye. I turned my head slowly, for I dared risk no swift movement. I discovered Nettle sitting calmly uphill from me, watching my agonized progress. She sat amongst grass and wildflowers. Her gown was green, and her hair decked with tiny daisies. Even to my father's eyes she looked more woman than child. But she sat like a little girl, her knees drawn up under the chin, and her arms clasped around her legs. Her feet were bare, and her eyes troubled. Such was our dichotomy. I still struggled to retain my footing on the unstable slope. In her dream, adjoining mine, she sat in a mountain meadow. Her presence forced me to admit that I dreamed, and yet I could not surrender the exertion of my nightmare. I did not know if I feared I would be swept to my death or thrust into wakefulness. So, "What is it?" I called to her as I continued my inching progress across the mountain's face. It mattered not how many steps I took. Solid ground remained ever distant, while Nettle kept her place above me.
"My secret," she said quietly. "It gnaws at me. So I have come to ask your advice."
She paused, but I did not reply. I did not want to know her secret or to offer advice. I could not commit myself to helping her. Despite the dream, I knew I was leaving Buckkeep soon. Even if I stayed, I could not venture into her life without the risk of destroying it. Better to remain a vague dream thing on the edge of her reality. Despite my silence, she spoke to me.
"If someone gives her word to keep silent about a thing, not realizing how much pain it will bring, not just to herself, but to others, is she bound to keep her word?"
That was too grave a question to leave unanswered.
"You know the answer to that," I panted. "A woman's word is her word. She keeps it, or it is worth nothing."
"But I did not know the trouble it would cause when I gave it. Nim goes about like half a creature. I did not know that Mama would blame Papa, nor that Papa would take to drink over it, blaming himself more deeply than she does.
I halted. It was dangerous to do so, but I turned to face her. Her words had plummeted me into a deeper danger than the chasm that yawned below me. I spoke carefully. And you think you found a way around the word you gave, to tell me what you promised not to tell them? She lowered her forehead to her knees. Her voice was muffled when she spoke.
You said you knew Papa long ago. I do not know who you truly are, but perhaps you know him still. You could speak to him. The last time Swift ran away, you told me when he and Papa were safely on their way home to us. Oh, please, Shadow Wolf. I don't know what your connection to my family is, but I know it exists. In trying to aid Swift, I have nearly torn us apart. I have no one else to turn to, and I have never promised Swift that I would not tell you.
I looked down at my feet. She had changed me into her image of me. Her dream was devouring mine. Now I was a man-wolf, my black claws dug into the loose gravel. Moving on all fours with my weight lower, I clawed my way up the slope towards her. When I was close enough to see the dried salt track of tears on her cheeks, I growled, "Tell me what?" It was all the permission she needed.
"They think Swift ran away to sea, for so we made it seem, he and I. Oh, do not look at me like that. You don't know what it was like around here. Papa was a perpetual storm cloud, and Swift near as bad. Poor Nim slunk around like a whipped dog, ashamed to win praise from Papa because his twin could not share it. And Mama. Mama was like a mad woman, every night demanding to know what ailed them, and both of them refusing to answer. There was no peace in our home any more, no peace at all, so when Swift came to me and asked me to help him slip away, it seemed the wise thing to do.
And what sort of aid did you give him?
I gave him money, money that was mine, to use as I pleased, money I had earned myself, helping with the Gossain's lambing last spring. Mama often sent him to town to make deliveries of honey or candles. I thought up the plan for him, that he would start asking neighbours and folk in town about boats and fishing in the sea. And then, at the last, I wrote a letter and signed Papa's name, as I have become accustomed to doing for him. His eyes. Papa can still write, but his hand wanders, for he cannot see the letters he is forming. So of late I have written things for him. The papers when he sells a horse and such. Everyone says that my hand is just like his, probably because he taught me to make my letters, so...
So you wrote a letter for Swift, saying that his father had released him, and that he could go forth and do as he pleased with his life. I spoke slowly. Every word she spoke burdened me more. Burrick and Molly quarrelled, and he took to drink again. His sight was failing him, and he believed he had driven his son away. Hearing these things rent me, for I knew I could not mend any of them.
It can be difficult for a boy to find any sort of work if folk think he is a runaway apprentice or a lad whose work still belongs to his father.
She spoke the words hesitantly, trying to excuse her forgery. I dared not look at her.
Mama packed up 6 racks of candles and sent Swift into town to deliver them and to bring back the money. When he said goodbye to me, I knew he meant to take that opportunity. He never came back.
Around her, flowers bloomed, and a tiny bee buzzed from one to the next, seeking nectar. I slowly worked through her words. He stole the candle money to travel on. My estimate of Swift dropped.
It wasn't exactly stealing. He'd always helped with the hives, and he needed it.
I shook my head slowly. It disappointed me that she found excuses for him. But then, I'd never had a little brother. Perhaps it was a thing all sisters did.
"Won't you help me?"
she asked piteously when my silence grew long. "I can't," I said helplessly. "I can't."
"Why not?"
"How could I?" I was completely in her dream now. The meadow grass was firm beneath my feet. A spring day in the hills surrounded me. The bee buzzed past my ear and I flicked it away. I knew my nightmare still lurked behind me. If I stepped back 2 paces, I'd be on that treacherous slope again.
"Talk to Papa for me. Tell him it wasn't his fault. Swift went away."
"I can't talk to your Papa. I'm far, far away. Only in dreams can we reach across distances like this."
Can't you visit his dreams as you do mine? Can't you talk to him there?
No, I can't. Long ago my father had sealed Burrick off from all other skill users. Burrick himself had told me that. Chivalry had been able to draw strength from him for skilling, and the bond between them meant that chivalry would be vulnerable through Burrick to other skill users. Dimly I wondered, did that mean that at one time Burrick had had some level of skill ability? Or did it only mean that the two men were so close that chivalry could take strength from him for skilling?
Why not? You come to my dreams, and you were friends long ago. You said so. Please, he can't go on as he is. It's killing him. And my mother,
she added softly.
I think you owe him this.
A bee from Nettle's flowers buzzed past my face, and I swiped at it. I decided I needed to end this contact swiftly. She was drawing too many conclusions about her father and me. I cannot come to your father's dreams, Nettle, but there may be something I can do. I may be able to speak to someone who can find Swift, and send him home again. Even as I said the words, my heart sank. As annoying as Swift was, I knew what it would mean to the boy to be sent back to Burrick. I hardened my will. It truly wasn't my problem. Swift was Burrick's son, and they must sort it out themselves.
Then you know where Swift is. You've seen him. Is he well? Is he safe? 1,000 times I've thought of him, so young and alone and out in the world. I never should have let him talk me into this. Tell me about him.
He's fine, I said shortly. The bee buzzed past my ear again. I felt it settle on the back of my neck. I tried to paw it off me, but an instant later I was bowed under the weight of a sizable animal on my back. I yelped and struggled, but before I could draw breath, I was dangling from the dragon's jaws. She gave me a shake, not to kill, but to caution. I stopped struggling and hung there. Her teeth gripped the scruff of my neck, not piercing either hide or flesh, but paralyzing me. As Nettle surged indignantly to her feet, reaching for me, the dragon lifted me higher. I dangled above Nettle, and then was swung out over the chasm from my earlier nightmare. The dragon cautioned us both.
Resist, and I drop him. Wolves do not fly.
Her words did not come from her mouth and throat, but penetrated my thoughts. A mind-to-mind touch. Nettle froze.
What do you want?
She growled. Her dark eyes had gone flinty.
He knows,
Tintaglia replied, giving me a small shake. I felt it unhinged, every bone in my spine.
I want to know all that you know of a black dragon buried in ice. I want to know all you know of an island human's name, Azlevial.
I know nothing of such things,
Nettle replied angrily. Her hands had knotted into fists.
Let him go!
Very well,
the dragon released me, and for a heart-stopping instant I plummeted. Then her head shot out on her snake-like neck, and she caught me up again. This time her jaws encompassed my ribs. She squeezed me, demonstrating how easily she could crush me. Then she eased the pressure and asked me,
And what do you know, little wolf thing?
Nothing, I gasped, and then choked out every bit of air in my lungs as she crushed me. It would be quick, I told myself. I would not have to maintain my lie long. She wasn't a patient creature. She'd kill me swiftly. I glanced back to take a last look at my daughter. Nettle stood, suddenly larger than she had been. Then she flung her arms wide, her hair tossed in a wind that only she felt, and then haloed out around her face. She threw her head back.
This is a dream, she shouted, and it is my dream. I cast you out of it.
The last she spoke as single words, uttered with all the command of a queen. For the first time, I comprehended the strength of my daughter's skill. Her ability to shape dreams and command that which happened in them was a manifestation of her skill talent. Tintaglia flung me, spinning out over an infinite void. Beneath me I saw not the rocky chasm of my dream, but a vast emptiness without colour or end. I had one whirling glimpse of the dragon writhing as Nettle dwindled her back to the size of a bee. Then I clenched my eyes shut against the dizzying fall. Even as I drew painful breath to scream, Nettle softly spoke by my ear.
"It's only a dream, Shadow Wolf, and it belongs to me. In my dreams you will never come to harm. Open your eyes now. Awake to your own world."
An instant before I awoke, I felt the comforting resistance of bedding beneath me. And when I opened my eyes to the darkness of my workroom, I was not in panic. Nettle had taken the terror from the nightmare. For a moment I felt relief. I drew a deep breath, and as I surrendered to sleep once more, I felt a drowsy amazement at my daughter's odd skill strength. But as I tugged my blanket back over my shoulder and reclaimed half the pillow from the ferret, the earlier portion of my dream dragged me back to wakefulness. Swift had lied. Burrick hadn't discarded him. Worse, his leaving had thrown the family into turmoil. I lay still, eyes closed, wishing vainly to sleep. Instead, I mapped out what I must do. The boy must be sent home, but I didn't want to be the one to do it. He'd demand to know how I knew he had lied. So I'd tell Chade that Burrick had not released Swift from his household. That would involve admitting to Chade that I'd had more skill contact with Nettle. Well, it couldn't be helped, I told myself, grumpily. All my secrets seemed intent on leaking out and becoming known. So I made my resolution, and tried to persuade myself that was the best I could do. I tried not to imagine Burrick going back to drinking every night, or Molly driven to distraction not only by her husband's dive into the bottle, but by her son's vanishing. I tried not to wonder how much Burrick's vision had faded, enough that he had either not tried to track his son, or had failed in the effort. I was up at dawn. I got bread and milk and bacon in the guardroom, and carried it out to the women's garden to eat it. I sat listening to the bird calls, and smelling the new day's warmth touching the earth. Such things have always been a deep comfort to me. This morning they affirmed that the goodness of the earth always goes on, and made me wish that I could stay to watch the summer grow strong and the fruit swell on the trees. I felt her before I saw her. Starling wore a morning robe of pale blue. Her hair was loose upon her shoulders, and her graceful narrow feet were in simple sandals. She carried a steaming mug between both her hands. I watched her and wished that things could have been simpler between us. When she noticed me sitting silently on the bench beneath the tree, she gaped in feigned astonishment, then changed her expression to a smile as she came to join me. She sat down, kicked her feet free of her sandals, and curled her legs on the bench between us. "Well, good morning," she greeted me. There was mild surprise in her eyes. "I nearly didn't recognize you, Fitz. You look as if you've lost 10 years.
"Tom," I reminded her gently, well knowing that she had dropped my old name to rattle me. "And I feel as if you are right. Perhaps the daily routine of a guardsman was what I needed all along." She made a skeptical noise in her throat and took a sip from her mug. When she looked up, she added sourly, "I notice you don't think the same is true for me." "What? That you'd do better as a guardsman?" I asked her innocently. Then, as she pretended to kick at me, I added, "Starling, you always look like Starling to me. Neither older nor younger than I expected you to be, but always Starling." She furrowed her brow for a moment, then shrugged and laughed. "I never know if you mean the things you say as compliments or not." Then she leaned closer to me, sniffing the air near me.
"Musk? Are you wearing musk these days, Tom Badgerlock? If you are interested in attracting female companionship..."
"No, I wear no musk. I've just been sleeping with a ferret," I had replied with honesty, and her whoop of laughter startled me. A moment later I was grinning with her as she shook her head at me. She shifted on the bench so that her sun-warmed thigh pressed against mine.
"That is so like you, Fitz. So like you."
She gave a sigh of contentment, and then asked lazily,
"Then, can I surmise that you have ended your morning and bonded again?"
Her words dimmed the summer morning for me. I cleared my throat and spoke carefully. "No. I doubt that I ever will. Night Eyes and I fit together like a knife and a sheath." I looked out over the chamomile bed and said quietly, "After him there can be no other. It would be a disservice to whatever creature I joined, for he would only be a substitute, and never genuinely my partner." She read more into my words than I intended. She put her arm along the back of the bench.
Pillowing her head on it, she looked up at the sky through the tree branches that shaded us. I finished the milk I had brought with me and set the cup aside. I was about to excuse myself for my morning lesson with Swift when she asked, "Have you ever thought of taking Molly back, then?" "What?" She lifted her head. "You love the girl. At least so you've always maintained. And she had your child, at great cost to herself. You know that she could have shaken it from her body if she had chosen. That she didn't means that she felt something deep for you. You should go to her. Take her back." "Molly and I were a long time ago. She's married to Burrick. They built a life together. They have 6 children of their own," I pointed out stiffly. "So?" She brought her gaze to meet mine. "I saw him when he came to Buckkeep to fetch Swift home. He was close-mouthed and grim when I greeted him, and he was old. He walks with a hitch, and his eyes are clouding." She shook her head over him. "If you decided to take Molly back from him, he could offer you no competition." "I would never do that." She sipped from her mug, looking at me steadily over the rim. "I know that," she said when she took the cup from her lips. "Even though he took her from you?" "They both think I'm dead," I pointed out to her, my voice harsher than I'd intended. "Are you sure you're not?" she asked flippantly. Then, at the look on my face, her eyes softened. "Oh, Fitz, you never do anything for yourself, do you? Never take what you want." She leaned closer to me. "Do you think Molly would have thanked you for your decision? Do you truly think you had the right to decide for her?" She leaned back a little, watching my face. "You gave her and the child away, as if you were finding a good home for a puppy. Why?" I'd answered that question so many times I didn't even need to think. He was the better man for her. That was true then. It's true now. Is it? I wonder if Molly would agree. "And how is your husband today?" I asked her roughly. Her glance went opaque. "Who knows? He's gone trout fishing in the hills with Lord and Lady Red Oaks. As you know, I've never enjoyed that kind of outing." Then, glancing aside, she added, "But their lovely daughter, Ivy, apparently does. I've heard that she leapt at the chance to make the trip." She did not need to explain it to me. I took her hand. "Starling, I'm sorry." She took a breath. "Are you? It matters little to me. I've his name and his holdings to enjoy, and he leaves me the freedom of my minstrel ways to come and go as I please." She cocked her head at me. "I've been thinking of joining Dutiful's entourage for the journey to the Out Islands. What do you think of that?" My heart lurched at the thought. Oh, no. "I think that it would be far worse than going trout fishing. I expect to be uncomfortable and cold for much of it, and out-island food is terrible. If they give you lard, honey, and bone marrow mixed together, you've had the height of their cuisine." She stood gracefully. "Fish paste," she said. "You've forgotten their fish paste. Fish paste on everything." She stood looking down on me. Then she reached a hand and pushed several strands of hair back from my face. Her fingertips walked the scar down my face. "Someday," she said quietly, "someday you'll realize that we were the perfect match, you and I. That in all of your days and places, I was the only one who truly understood you and loved you despite it." I gaped at her. In all our years together, she'd never said the word love to me. She slid her fingers under my chin and closed my mouth for me. "We should have breakfast together more often," she suggested. Then she strolled away, sipping from her cup as she went, knowing that I watched her go. "Well, at least you can make me forget all of my other problems for a time," I observed quietly to myself. Then I took my mug back to the kitchen and headed for the Queen's Gardens. Perhaps it was my conversation with Starling, for when I walked out on the tower top and found the boy feeding the doves, I was direct. "You lied," I said before he could even give me a good morning. "Your father never sent you away. You ran off, and you stole money to do it." He gaped at me. His face went white. How do I know? If I answer that question for you, I'll answer it for Chade and the Queen as well. Do you want them to know what I know? I prayed I had his measure. When he gulped and shook his head suddenly and silently, I knew I had. Given the chance to run home, with no one here the wiser as to how he had shamed himself, he'd take it. Your family is worried sick about you. You've no right to leave people who love you in suspense about your fate. Pack up and go, boy, just as you came. Here. Impulsively, I took my purse from my belt. There's enough here to see you safely home and pay back what you took. See that you do. He couldn't meet my eyes. Yes, sir. When he didn't reach for the purse, I took his hand in mine, turned it palm up, and put the sack into it. When I let go of his hand, he still stood staring up at me. I pointed at the door to the stairwell. He turned, stunned, and stumbled towards the door. With his hand on it, he halted.
You don't understand what it's like for me there,
he whispered feebly. Yes, I do. Far better than you might imagine. Go home, bow your head to your father's discipline, and serve your family until you reach your majority, as an honest boy should. Didn't your parents raise you? Didn't they give you life, put food on your table, clothes on your back, shoes on your feet? Then it is only right that your labour belongs to them until you are legally a man. Then you can openly go your own way. You will have years after that to discover your magic. Years of your own, rightfully earned, to live as you please. Your wit can wait until then. He halted by the door and leaned his head against it for a moment.
No, my magic won't wait.
It will have to, I told him harshly. Now go home, Swift. Leave today. He ducked his head, pushed the door open, and left, shutting it behind him. I listened to his fading footsteps on the stair, and felt his presence fade from my wit sense. Then I let out my breath in a long sigh. I had sent him to do a hard thing. I hoped Burrick's son had the spine to do it. I hoped, without real belief, that the boy's return would be enough to mend the family. I wandered over to the parapet wall and stood staring down at the rocks below. Chapter 5. Departures. Do not disdain those who find that their strongest skill talent is in the fashioning of dreams. It is a talent most often manifested among solos. These lone skill users, while not as effective as a coterie, can employ their unique talents to serve their monarchs in ways both subtle and effective. Ominous dreams sent to an enemy lord can make him reconsider his actions, while dreams of victory and glory can fortify the courage of any military leader. Dreams can be rewards, and in some cases can offer balm to those who are discouraged or weary at heart. Treacne's Lesser Uses of the Skill. That evening I told Chade that Swift had become desperately homesick, and that I'd sent him home in the hopes that he could mend things with Burrick. The old man nodded distractedly. The boy was the least of his concerns. I also told him of my conversation with Webb, finishing with, "He knows who I am. I think he has since he arrived here." Chade's reaction to that was more emphatic. "Damn! Why must you start coming unravelled now, when I have so much else to deal with?" "I don't think I'm unravelling," I said stiffly. "Rather, I think that this is knowledge that someone has possessed all along, and now it has come round to bite us. What do you suggest I do?"
"Do? What can you do?" he demanded testily. "It's known, boy. All we can do is hope that Webb truly has as much goodwill towards us as he appears to have, and that the knowledge is not widespread amongst the witted." He thumped a leather case to settle the scrolls inside, and then began to tie it shut.
"Holly, you say?" he asked after a moment. "You think Holly told Webb?"
So he seemed to imply.
"And when is the last time you saw her?"
"Years ago, when I lived among the witted. She was Rolf's wife."
"I know that. My wits aren't failing me that badly,"
he pondered while he rolled the next scroll up.
"There isn't time," he finally announced. "I'd send you off to see this Holly, if there was, to discover how many people she has told, but there just isn't time. So, think with me, Fitz. How will they use this? I'm not sure that Webb intends to use it at all. The way he said it was as if he wished to help me. I felt no threat from him, nor even that he was holding my secret over my head. It was more as if he were urging me toward honesty with Swift as the best way to break through to him. "Hmm," the old man replied thoughtfully, tying the last case shut. "Push the teapot this way." Then, as he poured, "Webb is a puzzle, isn't he? The man knows a great deal, and it isn't just those witted tales he tells. I could not call him an educated man, yet, as he puts it, anything he has ever decided he needed to know, he's found a way to learn." Chade's gaze went distant as he spoke. Plainly, he had spent some time pondering Webb's significance. I did not like Sybil's proposal that Dutiful have a witted coterie, as he did not have a skilled one. No public mention has been made of such a thing, yet, nonetheless, it seems to have come into existence. There is Sybil Brisinga with his cat, that minstrel Cockle, and Webb. All plan to accompany us on this voyage, and I sense, though the prince is reluctant to speak of it, that they are a coterie of sorts. There is a closeness when all of them are in the room that excludes me. Webb is plainly the heartstone of the group. He is more like a priest than a leader. That is, he does not command, but he counsels them, and speaks often of serving the spirit of the world, or the divine. He has no qualms that such words may make him appear foolish. If he had ambitions, he'd be a dangerous man. With what he knows, he could bring all of us tumbling down. The very few times he has spoken to me, it has been in a very indirect way. I feel as if he is urging us toward an action. But he does not tell us what it is that he hopes we will do. So, I ticked the possibilities off on my fingers. Maybe Webb simply wanted me to be honest with Swift. Well, with the boy gone, that's no longer an issue. But perhaps he wants me to reveal to all who I really am. Or perhaps he wants the Farseers to admit that the prince is witted. Or, if the two things were presented at once, it would be as good as saying that the wit runs in the Farseer blood. And then my tongue froze. Did the wit truly run in the Farseer line? The last prince to have definitely had it was the piebald prince, and he had left no issue. The crown had passed to a different Farseer bloodline, so perhaps I had got the wit from my mountain-bred mother, and passed it on when Verity had usurped my body for the conception of Dutiful. That was a little bit of the puzzle that I had never given Chade. Nor did I ever intend to. Dutiful, I was convinced, was the son of Verity's spirit. Yet now I wondered uncomfortably if by the use of my body Verity had passed on some of my tainted magic to his son. "Fitz," Chade said, and I startled at his voice, my thoughts having carried me so far afield. "Don't worry so. If Webb meant to do us harm, there'd be little advantage in tipping his hand. He's going with us on the prince's quest, so we can keep an eye on him, and talk to him. You, especially, should seek him out. Pretend you wish to learn more of the wit. That will win him over to you." I sighed softly. I was sick of deception. I said as much to Chade. He snorted callously. "You were born for deception, Fitz. Born for it. Just as I was. Just as all bastards are. We're tricky things, sons but not heirs, royal but not princes. I would have thought that by now you would have accepted that." I only said, "I'll try to get to know Webb better on the voyage and see what he's about." Chade nodded sagely. "A ship's a good place to do that, little for men to do but talk on a voyage. And if he proves to be a danger to us, well..." He didn't have to say that many mishaps could befall a man at sea. I wished he had said nothing at all, but he was talking on. "Did you put it into Starling's head to go with us? For she asked, gave the queen a long-winded speech about how a minstrel should go to bring home a clean telling of the prince's adventure." "Not I. Did the queen give her permission?" "I refused it, saying that all the places on the prince's ship were already spoken for, and that the minstrel Cockle had already claimed a spot. Why, do you think she'd be useful?" "No. I fear this may be like the last quest I went on. The less truth that comes home with us, the better." I was relieved that Chade had refused Starling, and yet some sneaking part of me was mildly disappointed. That feeling shamed me too much to examine it closely. The next day, I managed to see Hap. It was only a brief visit, and we talked while he worked.
One of the journeymen was doing an inlay project and had asked Hap to do the sanding of the pieced bits. It looked deadly dull to me, but Hap seemed absorbed in the work when I approached him. He smiled wearily when I greeted him, and gravely accepted the small gifts and mementos I'd brought him. When I asked how he was, he didn't pretend to misunderstand.
Svenja and I are still together. Her parents still don't know. And I'm still juggling that with my duties as an apprentice. But I think I'm managing it. My hope is that if I apply myself here, I can make journeyman quickly. Once I have that status, I think I can present myself to Svenja's father as a likely marriage prospect for his daughter.
He sighed.
I'm so tired of the sneaking about, Tom. I think Svenja relishes it, that it makes it more exciting for her, but for me, well, I like things settled and done right. Once I'm a journeyman, I can make everything as it should be.
I bit my tongue before saying that apprenticeships lasted years, not months. We both knew that. What mattered was that Hap was not shirking his training, but delving into it in the hopes of realizing his dreams. What more could I ask of him? So I embraced my son and told him I would be thinking of him. The hug he returned me was fierce.
I won't shame you, Tom. I promise I won't shame you.
With the rest of the guardsmen, I loaded my sea chest onto a wagon and followed it down to the docks. Buckkeep Town was decked for Springfest. Flowers garlanded door lintels and banners fluttered. The doors to taverns and common houses stood open, with song and the smell of holiday food wafting from them. Some of the men grumbled about missing the holiday, but the first day of spring was a fortuitous day for beginning a journey. Tomorrow morning, we'd make a show of escorting the prince aboard. Today we boarded the Maiden's Chance and jostled companionably for space on the lower deck allotted to us. Our area was dark, airless, and thick with the stink of men in close quarters and the bilge below us. I hit my head twice on the low joists, and after that walked hunched. We would be crowded cheek by jowl, with little privacy and no quiet. The smoke-darkened timbers seemed to breathe out a miasma of oppressiveness. The water lapped loudly against the outside of the hull, as if to remind me that only a plank of wood stood between the cold, wet sea and me. I stowed my gear quickly, already anxious to be out of there. I little cared where my trunk was lashed down. I resolved to spend as much time above deck in the open air as I could. About half the guard were veterans of this sort of journey. They made much of the fact that we had an area separate from the working sailors, whom they despised as drunks, thieves, and brawlers. Personally, I suspected the seamen regarded the guardsmen in much the same light. I settled my belongings quickly and headed up to the deck. I could not linger there, for it was crowded with sailors and passengers, all with some task in mind that involved pushing past me. Crates were being lifted from the docks and swung overhead, before being guided down through the hatches and stowed below decks. The sailors who weren't shouting at each other were swearing loudly about the landsmen in their way. Once on the docks again, I breathed a sigh of relief. All too soon I'd be trapped aboard that ship with no opportunity to escape. But as I came down the gangway, my relief evaporated. On the dock stood the fool, as Lord Golden, fuming. A retinue of servants bearing boxes, crates, bags, and packages of all descriptions stood behind him. Blocking him was a harassed scribe with a scroll. He was shaking his head, his eyes nearly shut, as Lord Golden harangued him.
"Well, obviously there has been a mistake. What seems to elude you is that the error is not mine. For months it has been settled that I am to accompany the prince on his quest. Who better can advise him than a man like me, who has travelled far and experienced many cultures? So take yourself out of my way. I myself shall select a suitable cabin, as you insist that none has been allotted to me, and move my comforts into it while you trot about and discover who is responsible for this gross error."
The scribe had never paused in his head-shaking, and when he spoke, I was certain he was repeating words he'd already uttered.
"Lord Golden, I humbly regret any error that has been made. My list came directly from Lord Chade's hands, and my instructions were most explicit. Only those listed here are to be settled aboard the prince's ship. Nor am I allowed to leave my post here to run and ask if some mistake has been made. My orders are quite clear on that."
As if hoping to be rid of Golden, he added,
"Perhaps you have been assigned to one of the accompanying vessels."
Lord Golden gave an exasperated sigh. As he turned to his servant, his eyes seemed to skate past me. But for the tiniest instant, our gazes met.
"Put that down," he commanded the man,
and the servant lowered a box to the ground with relief. Lord Golden promptly sat down on it. As he crossed his green hosed legs, he gestured imperiously at all of his other servants.
All of you, set your burdens down where you are.
But you're blocking the... Please, Lord Golden.
He ignored the scribe's anguish.
Here I shall remain until this matter is resolved,
he announced in a wounded voice. He crossed his arms on his chest. Lifting his chin, Lord Golden gazed out over the waters as if nothing else in the world concerned him at all. The scribe darted a look past him. His servants and equipment formed an effective blockade of the dock. Other passengers were beginning to clog the docks behind him, and longshoremen with barrows and tubs of supplies were gathering too. The scribe took a breath and tried to summon authority.
"Sir, you will have to remove yourself and your belongings until this is resolved."
"I shall not. So I suggest you send a runner to Lord Chade and have him give you the authority to let me board, for nothing less will satisfy me."
My heart sank. I knew that Lord Golden's remark was intended more for me than for the scribe. He had seen me. He expected I would hasten back to Buckkeep Castle and drop a word in Chade's ear that would bring a speedy solution to his quandary. He did not yet suspect that his difficulty was of my making, and that even if I regretted it, Chade would stand firm. As I turned away from the milling spectacle he was creating, I saw him give me the ghost of a wink. No doubt he thought that Lord Golden's grand departure from Buckkeep Town would become one of the town's legends. I wanted to see no more of it. As I trudged up the steep streets that led back to the castle, I told myself there was no reason to agonize. Lord Golden would sit there until evicted from the spot, no worse than that. And when we sailed tomorrow without him, well, he'd remain safely in Buckkeep whilst the rest of us went off to whatever discomfort and boredom the journey could offer us. No worse than that. Nonetheless, the rest of the day dragged for me. After days of last-minute rushing, I found my final hours empty. There was nothing left to do. My space in the guard barracks was empty of all save the clothing and weapon I would wear on the morrow. The prince's guard would go forth handsomely. Leggings, shirt, and over-tunic were all of Buckkeep blue. The farseer buck was embroidered on the breast. My new boots had been made to my feet and didn't pinch. I'd already greased them well against wet. Although it was spring, the cloaks we'd been given were of thick wool against the expected cold of the out-islands. The fool's gift sword, laid out atop my colours, seemed like a rebuke. I left it there. Safe as anything was safe, in a barracks where a man's honour was most of what he possessed in the world. In my tower workroom, it was much the same. If Chade had noticed that Chivalry's sword now hung over the mantelpiece, he'd chosen not to comment on it. I moved ineffectually around the room, putting away the things that Chade had left scattered from his packing. The charts of the out-islands and all other writings that Chade thought might be needed had already been packed. For lack of anything else to do, I lay on the bed and teased the ferret. But soon even Gilly tired of that. He went off to hunt rats. I took myself off to the steams, scrubbed myself raw, and then shaved twice. Afterwards, I went to my barracks and got into the narrow bed there. The rest of the long room was quiet and nearly deserted. Only a few old hands had chosen an early bed as I had. The others were out and about Buckkeep Town, bidding the taverns and whores farewell. I pulled the blankets up around me and stared up at the shadowed ceiling. I wondered how hard the fool would try to follow us. Chade had assured me that he wouldn't be able to get passage out of Buckkeep Town. He'd have to travel to a different port and pay a lot of money to persuade a ship's captain to sail after us. Lord Golden wouldn't have that money. After his recent escapades, I doubted he'd find any friends willing to loan him any. He'd be stuck. And furious with me, I decided. He had a keen mind. He'd soon deduce who had been behind his abandonment. He would know that I had chosen his life over what he perceived as his destiny. He'd feel no gratitude. His catalyst was supposed to aid him in changing the course of the world, not thwart him. I closed my eyes and sighed. It took me several tries to compose myself. When finally I floated just beneath the surface of sleep, I reached out for Nettle. This time she was sitting in an old oak tree, wearing a gown of butterfly wings. I looked up at her from the knoll beneath the tree. I was the man-wolf, as I always was in her dreams. "All those dead butterflies," I said sorrowfully, shaking my head at her.
"Don't be silly, it's only a dream."
She stood up on the branch and leapt. I reared onto my hind legs and opened my arms to catch her, but the butterflies of her gown all fluttered simultaneously, and she floated, light as thistledown, and landed on her feet beside me. She wore one large yellow butterfly in her hair like a hair ribbon. It slowly fanned its wings. The colour of her gown shifted in waves as the butterflies wafted their wings lazily.
"Oh, don't all the little legs tickle?"
"No, it's a dream, remember? You don't have to keep the unpleasant parts."
"You never have nightmares, do you?" I asked in admiration.
"I think that I used to when I was very small. But I don't any more. Why would anyone stay in a dream that didn't please her?"
"Not all of us can control our dreams the way you can, child. You should count it as a blessing."
"Do you have nightmares?"
"Sometimes. Don't you recall where you found me last time crossing that talus slope?"
"Oh, yes, I remember that. But I thought it was something you liked to do. Some men like doing dangerous things, you know."
"Perhaps. But some of us have had our fill of that, and would avoid nightmares if we could." She nodded slowly.
"My mother has terrible nightmares sometimes. Even when I go into them and tell her to come out, she won't. She either won't or can't see me. And my father, I know he has bad dreams because sometimes he shouts aloud, but I can't find my way into his dreams at all."
She stopped for a moment's thought.
"I think that's why he started drinking again. When he's drunk, he passes out instead of falling asleep. Do you think he could be hiding from his nightmares?"
"I don't know," I said, and wished she had not told me such things. "I bring you news that may ease both of them, however. Swift is on his way back home." She clasped her hands together and took a deep breath.
"Oh, thank you, Shadow Wolf. I knew you could help me."
I tried to be stern. "I wouldn't have to help you if you'd used common sense. Swift is far too young to be out and about on his own. You shouldn't have helped him run away."
"I know that now, but I didn't then. Why can't real life be like dreams? In a dream, if something starts to go wrong, you can simply change it."
She lifted her hands to her shoulders and smoothed them down the front of her gown. Suddenly she was wearing a dress of poppy petals.
"See? No tickly legs now. You just have to tell the parts you don't like to go away."
"Like you send away the dragon."
"The dragon?"
"You know who I mean. Tintaglia. She appears small at first, as a lizard or a bee, and then becomes larger until you vanquish her."
"Oh, her."
Her brow furrowed.
"She only comes when you do. I thought she was a part of your dream."
"No, she's not a part of anyone's dream. She's as real as you and me." It suddenly disturbed me that Nettle had not perceived that. Had our dream conversations exposed her to a greater danger than I knew?
"Who is she, then, when she is awake?"
"I told you, she's a dragon."
"There's no such thing as dragons,"
she declared with a laugh, shocking me into momentary silence. "You don't believe in dragons? Then who saved the 6 duchies from the Red Ship raiders?"
"Soldiers and sailors, mostly, I suppose. It hardly matters anyway, does it? It happened so long ago."
"It matters a great deal to some of us," I muttered. "Especially to the ones who were there."
"I'm sure it does. Yet I've noticed that few, if any, can tell a straight tale of exactly what happened to save the 6 duchies, just that they saw the dragons in the distance, and that the next thing they knew, the red ships were sinking or broken, and the dragons were almost out of sight."
"Dragons have a strange effect upon people's memories," I explained to her. "They seem to absorb them as they pass over people, like a cloth wiping up spilled beer." She grinned up at me.
"So, if that's true, why doesn't Tintaglia have that effect on us? How is it that we can remember her being in our dreams?"
I held up a warning hand. "Let's not use her name any more. I've no wish to encounter her again. As to why we can remember her, well, I think it is because she comes to us as a dream creature rather than in the flesh. Or it could be that she does not take our memories because she is a creature of flesh and blood instead of..." I recalled to whom I was speaking and halted. I was telling her too much. If I did not guard my tongue soon, I'd be telling her about skill-carving dragons from memory stone, and how those creatures were the elderlings of tale and song.
"Go on," she urged me. "If Tintaglia is not of flesh and blood, then what else could she be? And why does she always ask us about a black dragon? Are you going to say that he is real too?"
"I don't know," I said cautiously. I don't even know if he exists at all. Let's not talk of that just now. I had felt nervous ever since she had mentioned Tintaglia's name. The word seemed to shimmer in the air, as betraying as the smoke from a cook fire. But if there was any truth to the old summoning magic of a name, we were spared that night. I bade her farewell. Somehow, in leaving her dream, I re-entered my old nightmare. The sliding pebbles of the steep slope promptly rolled away under my feet. I was falling, falling to my death. I heard Nettle's outflung cry of, "Change it to flying, Shadow Wolf! Make it a flying dream instead!" But I did not know how to heed her. Instead, I jerked upright in my narrow cot in the barracks. Morning was near, and most of the beds were filled now. Yet there was still a small time left for sleep. I tried to find it, but could not, and arose earlier than usual. None of my fellows were stirring. I put on my new uniform and spent some time trying to persuade my hair to stay out of my face. I had shorn it for grief at Nighteye's death, and it had not yet grown enough to stay bound back in a warrior's tail. I tied it back into a ridiculous stub, knowing it would soon pull free to hang about my face and brow. I went to the guardroom and ate heartily of a lavish breakfast the kitchens had prepared for us. I knew I was bidding farewell to land food for a time, and availed myself of hot meat, fresh bread and porridge with honey and cream. Meals on the ship would depend on the weather, and most of it would be salted, dried, and plainly cooked. If the water were rough and the cook judged fire too dangerous, we'd get cold food and hard bread. The prospect did not cheer me. I returned to the barracks to find most of the guard stirring to wakefulness. I watched the rest of the men-at-arms don their blue tunics and complain about the weight of wool cloaks on a warm spring day. Chade had never admitted it, but there were a half-dozen of our company who I suspected were as much spies as guardsmen. There was a quiet watchfulness about them that made me think they saw more than they seemed to. Riddle, a youngster of about 20, was most emphatically not. He was as excited as I was jaded. A dozen times he consulted his mirror, paying particular attention to a rather new moustache. He was the one who insisted on loaning me pomade for my hair, saying he could not allow me to set forth on such an important day looking like a shaggy-haired farmer. He himself, dressed for display and seated on his bunk, tapped his feet impatiently on the floor and kept up a constant stream of chatter, everything from teasing me about the ornate hilt on my sword to demanding whether I knew if it was true that dragons could be slain only with an arrow to the eye. His loose energy was as annoying as a pacing dog. I was relieved when Longwick, our newly appointed captain, tersely ordered us to form up outside. Not that the order meant imminent departure. It meant only that it was time for us to stand in formation and wait. Guardsmen spend more time waiting than they ever do in drill or fighting. This morning was no exception. Before we were ordered to move, I'd listened to a very explicit account of all three of Hest's liaisons of the night before, while Riddle helpfully asked detailed questions. When we did get the order to move, it was only as far as the courtyard in front of the main doors. Here we formed up around the prince's horse and groom, and waited some more. Servants and lackeys who, like ourselves, were dressed and deployed to show their master's importance, soon joined us. Some held horses' heads, some leashed dogs, and some, like us, merely stood, armed and attired and waiting. Eventually, the prince and his entourage emerged. Thick was at his heels, and Sada, the woman who tended him on such occasions, was right behind him. Dutiful spared no glance for me today. I was as faceless as the rest. The queen and her men preceded us, while Councillor Chade and his escort came immediately behind us. I spotted Civil, with his cat by his side, chatting with Webb, as they found their places in the procession. Despite Chade's objection, the Queen had announced that several of her old-blood friends would travel with the Prince. The court reaction had been mixed, with some saying that we'd soon see if old-blood magic was good for anything, and others muttering that at least it got the beast magickers out of Buckkeep. Behind them came the favoured nobles who would accompany the Prince, both to curry favour with him and to investigate trading opportunities in the Out-Islands. Behind them trailed those who would bid us farewell and then enjoy Springfest, but although I craned my neck I saw no sign of Lord Golden as the procession formed up. By the time Dutiful was up and mounted, and we were striding out of the gate, it seemed as if all of Buckkeep Castle were following us. I was grateful to be in the forefront, for by the time all passed, the road would be a trampled mire of mud and manure. We reached the ships, but could not simply load and depart. There were speeches and presentations of flowers and last-minute gifts. I had half expected to find Lord Golden and his baggage and servants still camped out on the docks, but there was no sign of them. I wondered uneasily what had happened. He was a resourceful man. Had he managed to find a way aboard the ship? I sweated through the formalities. Then we moved aboard the ship, flanking the prince, who went to his cabin, where he would receive farewell visits from the nobles who were not accompanying him, while those who were to be passengers boarded the ship and settled. Some of us were stationed outside the prince's cabin, but the rest, including myself, was sent below decks to be out of the way. I spent most of that miserable afternoon sitting on my sea chest. Above me, the planks resounded with the noise of people coming and going. Somewhere, a dog barked in a continuous frenzy. It was like being stuck inside a cask while someone beat on the outside of it. A dim, smelly cask, I amended to myself, with the rising stink of the bilges elbow to elbow with men who thought they had to shout to be heard. I tried to distract myself by wondering what had become of the fool, but that only increased my sensation of suffocation. I bowed my chin to my chest, closed my eyes, and tried to be alone. It didn't work. Riddle perched on my sea chest beside me.
Ida's tits, but it stinks down here. Think it'll get worse when we're underway and the bilge is sloshing about?
Probably. I didn't want to think of that before it happened. I'd travelled by sea before, but on those voyages I'd slept on the deck, or at least had a free access to it. Here, in the confined darkness, even the rhythmic swaying of the ship against its mooring was giving me a headache.
Well,
he kicked his heels against the chest, sending the vibration up my spine into my head.
I never have been to sea before. Have you?
Once or twice, on little boats, where I had light and air. Not like this.
Oh, ever been to the Out Islands?
No.
Are you all right, Tom?
Not really. Too much to drink, and not enough sleep last night. It was a lie, but it worked. He grinned, gave me a friendly jostle that made me snarl, and then left me alone. The bustle and noise pressed me from all sides. I was miserable and frightened, and I wished I hadn't eaten all the sweet pastries at breakfast. No one was paying attention to me. My collar was too tight, and Sada had already left the ship so she couldn't fix it for me.
Thick,
I whispered, recognizing the source of my woe. I sat up straight, drew a deep breath of the foul air, and tried not to retch. Then I reached for him.
Hey, little man, are you all right?
No.
Where are you?
In a little room. There's a round window and the floor moves.
You're better off than me. I've got no window at all.
The floor moves.
I know. But we'll be fine. Soon all the extra people will get off the boat and the sailors will throw the lines free and we'll set off on our adventure. Won't that be fun?
No. I want to go home.
Oh, it'll be better once we get underway. You'll see.
No, it won't. The floor moves, and Sada said I'd get seasick.
I wished someone had thought to tell Sada to speak positively of the journey to come. Is Sada coming with us, then? Is she on board?
No, only me, by myself, because Sada gets horribly sick on ships. She felt very sorry for me that I had to go. She said every day on a ship is like a year to her. And there's nothing to do except be sick and vomit and vomit and vomit.
Unfortunately, Thick was right. It was late afternoon before the well-wishers were escorted from the ship. I managed to get up on the deck, but only briefly, for the captain cursed all the guard, ordering us to get back down below to give his crew room to work. My glimpse of the crowd on the docks did not show me the fool. I had dreaded to meet his accusing stare, but it worried me even more not to see him there. Then I was herded below decks with the rest, and the hatches were closed over us, cutting off what little light and air we'd had before. I perched on my sea chest again. The resinous smell of the ship's tarry timbers intensified. Overhead, the captain ordered the ship's boats to tow us away from the dock. The sound changed as we began to move through the water. The captain shouted incomprehensible commands, and I heard the pattering of bare feet as sailors rushed to obey them. I heard the ship's boats called back and taken in. The vessel gave a sort of dip, and then the rhythm of the motions changed again. I judged that our canvas had caught the wind. This was it. We were finally underway. Someone took pity on us down below and opened the hatch a crack, which taunted more than comforted. I stared at the skinny band of light.
"I'm already bored," Riddle confided to me.
He stood next to me, carving on the heavy planks of the hull. I made a noise at him. He went on carving.
"Well, Tom Badgerlock, we're underway. How do you fare down below? The prince sounded cheery, but what could one expect of a 15-year-old off on a sea voyage to slay a dragon and win the hand of an Archeska? I could sense Chade in the background and pictured him at a table next to the prince, Dutiful's fingers lightly touching the back of his hand. I sighed. We still had a lot of work to do to make the skill coterie work. I'm already bored, and Fick seems distressed.
Ah, I was hoping you'd appreciate a task. I'll send a man to your captain. Fick is at the after rail and could use some company. You'll be joining him.
That was unmistakably Chade, speaking through the prince.
Is he sick already?
Not quite, but he has convinced himself that he will be.
Well, at least it would get me out into the air, I thought sourly.
A short time later, Captain Longwick called out my name. When I reported to him, he informed me that I was to tend the prince's man, Thick, who was indisposed on the afterdeck. The men who overheard my orders chivied me for being nursemaid to a halfwit. I grinned and replied that being above decks watching over one simpleton was far better than being trapped below decks with a troop of them. I climbed the ladder and emerged into the fresh sea air. I found Thick on the afterdeck, holding on to the railing and staring dolorously back at Buckkeep. The black castle on top of the rocky cliffs was dwindling behind us. Civil stood near the little man, his hunting cat at his heels. Neither he nor the cat looked pleased to be there, and as Thick leaned out over the railing and made retching noises, the cat flattened his ears.
"Here's Tom Badgerlock, Thick. You'll be fine now, won't you?"
Civil gave me a brief nod, nobleman to guardsman. As always, he stared at me searchingly. He knew I was not what I seemed. I'd saved his life from the piebalds back in Buckkeep Town. He had to wonder at how I'd suddenly appeared and come to his aid. He'd have to keep wondering, just as I had to wonder how much Loudwine had told him about Lord Golden and me. We'd never spoken of it, nor did I intend to now. I made my eyes opaque and bowed. "I'm here to assume my duties, sir." My tone was neutrally respectful.
"I'm very glad to see you. Well, farewell, Fick. You're in good hands now. I'm going back to the cabin. I'm sure you'll feel better soon."
"I'm going to die,"
Thick replied dismally.
"I'm going to puke my guts out and die."
Civil gave me a sympathetic look. I pretended not to see it as I took my place at the railing alongside Thick. He leaned far out again, forcing gagging sounds from his throat. I held onto the back of his jacket. Ah, yes. The Adventure of Travel by Sea.
Chapter 6. Voyage of Dreams. Despised beast magic's other uses. The ignorant believe that the wit can only be used to give humans the power to speak to animals, words obscured by scorching, and shape changing for evil intent. Gunroddy Leon, the last man to admit openly at Buckkeep Court that he had large fragment burned away, also for healing the mind as well. From beasts, too, he claimed they could harvest the instinctive knowledge of curative herbs, as well as a wariness against, this portion ends here, next scorched fragment of scroll begins, set hand to her head and held her steady and looked in her eyes. So he stood over her while the ghastly surgery was done, and she never looked away from him, nor cried out in agony. This I myself saw, but, again, into the scorched edge of the scroll, the next three words may be, dared not tell. Falstar's attempt to recreate the wit scroll by Skillmaster Leftwell, from the burned fragments discovered in a wall of Buckkeep Castle. I managed to get all the way to the next morning before I vomited myself. I lost count of how many times I held onto Thick while he leaned far over the railing and retched hopelessly at the sea. The taunting of the sailors did not help matters, and if I had dared leave his side, I'd have taken some satisfaction from one or two of them. It was not congenial mockery of a landsman with no stomach for the sea. There was an ugly undercurrent to it, like crows drawn to torment a single eagle. Thick was different. A dimwit, with a clumsy body, and they gleefully delighted in his misery as proof that he was inferior to them. Even when a few other miserable souls joined us